Good morning, it's Narki Street Congregation, the Bible study. My name is Brian Schultz. I used to live here in the country for a dozen years, and I've since relocated to the United States, but I'm privileged to be here for about a semester in order to, well, in order, because I had a sabbatical, basically. So let's start with a word of prayer, and then I'll introduce what I would like to look at today. Heavenly Father, thank you for the rain. We know the land needs it, and we thank you because you mentioned that we know that you are a good God because you cause it to rain on the just and on the unjust, and that you do not discriminate, and that that is a symbol of your love for us. In the same way that you are merciful to us, when we are faithful and when we are unfaithful, you still bless us. So thank you for that reminder. Thank you also that we live in a part of the world where there is peace, relatively, that we have the freedom to come together, that we don't have to worry about threats to our coming together. So we bless you for this time, and we ask that you might speak to our hearts. You know where each one of us is in our walk with you, in our journey to be disciples of Jesus. May the words of my mouth be used by your Spirit to speak to the thoughts of everyone's hearts here, and draw them closer to you, and motivate us all towards more faithful obedience to your teachings. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
So what I'd like to do today, I've done the Bible study a few times in the past, and we've looked at the life of Abraham. And I would like to go back and do that again, except I'm going to do it very differently than the last few times. The last few times I did it, we did it looking at every minutiae. And we were going at rocket speed, meaning we got about 10 verses done. No, we did a little bit more than that. But this time I would like to try to do a survey, kind of the life of Abraham up to a certain point. Because as I've thought about it, it's given me I'm going to call it an improved perspective, I think, on the life of Abraham. And to tie it in specifically today we celebrate All Saints Day. And it is a day to remember those who've gone before us. And I would like it for us to remember specifically Abraham, who went before us. He's often called the father of faith. And I want to take a look at his life and try to help unpack why it is that he has, if I can put it this way, earned that distinction. And I've never done this before, so I have no clue how it's going to go. But what we're going to do is we're just going to go through, and I'll read snippets as we go along. I didn't bring my physical Bible, so I'm dealing off the iPad right here, which is a little bit harder to skim through. But nonetheless, we'll give it a whirl and see how it goes. So we'll start. I'm going to start with some brief review right at the beginning. Genesis 12. It says this: Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you. There's the command that's given to him. One command: just go. A few extra details, you know, leave the people behind, go to a land that I'll show you. And then there's a series of, I'm going to call them, it's not quite this way, but I'm going to call them conditional promises. The way that it's written in Hebrew. It's not entirely conditional, but it leans towards the conditional side. It says, I will make you into a great nation, and I'm going to change will to would, just to remind us of that fact that these are not hard and fast promises. You know, there's a way that it's written in the Hebrew, it's not, I will for certain do this, no matter what. Okay, so that's why I'm going to add would in there. So, I would make you a great nation, I would bless you, and I would make your name great, so that you would be a blessing. And I would bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And I just want to emphasize that there's a change right there in the Hebrew. And in you, all the families of the earth would be blessed or will see a blessing for themselves, or it's a hard verse here to understand. But the highlight that I want to say right here is that when Abraham gets this commandment, he knows that God is saying that if you obey, he'll be made into a great nation. We also highlighted the fact that at this point he's at least 65 years old. I think we'll read it shortly right after this. 75 years old, sorry. And he has one wife, who's introduced to us in chapter 11, Sarai. And she's 10 years younger, so she's 65. And they're both well past the stage of having any kids. And in the study that we did already, I highlighted the point that I don't think Abraham at this point thought, oh, I'm going to have kids. I think rather that this command to be made into a great nation, to him, implied that something would happen down the road that would result in a great nation being formed around him. And we suggested several ways that this could happen. One is people could be drawn to him as a leader, and therefore he would become the leader of this nation. And I think that is a much more realistic way of trying to understand how Abraham perceived the outworking of this commandment. Of this promise that God was making to him, and that he wasn't at all thinking that it would be through his own descendants. A second possible way that he might have seen this is through his nephew Lot. We know that Lot ends up joining in with Abraham, chooses to leave with Abraham and go to wherever Abraham's going. And it might be that since Lot is his nephew and his brother had passed away, that in typical Middle Eastern fashion, this is being the larger family, and that therefore it won't happen directly through me, but it might take place through Lot. You know, I'm the one who's kind of the leader in this whole thing, therefore this commandment or this promise of being made into a great nation will find its fulfillment through Lot and his descendants, since I do not have any descendants. And by this time, there's not a question as to whether or not there would be descendants. I don't think. Okay, so Abram does it, and he leaves, and he goes with Lot, and he gets all the way to the land of Canaan, and there he gets there, and the Lord appears to him again, and I want to read that passage, and it says, "And to your offspring I will give this land." And here, I still think that Abraham does not understand this as being his own personal descendants. I think he sees it in the broader scope of things, that he's the patriarch now of a family, of a clan, and he's at the top of it. Lot has kind of joined himself. Some people have even suggested that maybe we could see it as an adoption type thing that took place. But I think he's seeing this promise that to your descendants, it blocks off this possibility that there'll be many other people who will join themselves to Abraham and therefore inherit this land. It's going to happen to his descendants, but I think he is thinking that this is going to happen with Lot. Then we have the whole incident of Abraham going down into Egypt, and we didn't deal with this in our Bible studies thus far, but the whole question of this passage in Egypt, to put it cleanly, is did they or didn't they? And I'm talking about Pharaoh and Sarah. Did they do it or didn't they do it? And the text leaves it somewhat ambiguous. We don't know what happens. We do know there's a curse that's going on. There's reasons to read the text and suggest that they didn't. And there's also reasons in the text to say, oh, she spent potentially a fair amount of time there in this place. So I just want to highlight it as there's a tension in the text. The text does not explicitly say that Pharaoh didn't do it. Okay? And if the text wanted to make that very, very clear, it could have said, but God prevented them. Now we have texts that are written later on that try to make that very, very clear that no, nothing bad happened. I'm thinking of the Genesis Apocrypha that's written in about the 3rd century BC, 2nd century BC. But here in the Bible, there's really no indication that forces us to go in one direction or the other. If, this is a big if, but I still want to put it out there because it might help us in the story, if the tension is left there intentionally, and we might want to think that maybe they did do it, what does that tell us about Sarah? That she is truly barren. Right? I mean, that's kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, it's been that way. Now we know, from a medical perspective, 20th century, the problem ain't Abraham. Mm-hmm. Right? The problem is more on Sarah's side. Now, we're going to get confirmation of that later on in the story. right? But this is where we're left to believe that, there's an issue right here, potentially. That, and again, I'm not trying to say that the text is saying that they did do it. But since there's ambiguity there, there's a question mark that's left. And potentially we should wonder, this is where the issue is, isn't it? Okay, so they come back super wealthy because Pharaoh is wanting to make sure that he doesn't get cursed any longer. And then we have him going down back to Bethel, and he comes back down to he's in Bethel, and then we have this whole incident that happens. I'm in 13 verse 8. If you want to try to follow through, Abram and Lot. What they've been doing, and I haven't highlighted this right now, but they've been journeying, basically following the weather cycle, the seasons of the year. When it's the summertime and it's not the growing period in the hill country, they're in the hill country grazing their flocks. When it gets to be the wintertime, he's going down into the Negev. That winter was a dry one, that's why he went out to Egypt. He comes back in, it's again the summertime, so he's back up in the hill country. And because of the local people who live there, and adding Abraham and Lot, there's a dynamic that's happening that there's overgrazing of the land. Sheep will graze right down to the roots and tear the roots of sheep, and goats will do that. And if you let the land be overgrazed, it will take several years before it can grow back, and so you need to keep moving. And you can't overgraze the land. And here what's happening, in addition to the locals, Abraham and Lot, they're overgrazing the land, and they need to find a solution. There's strife happening between Lot's shepherds and Abraham's shepherds, and so there's this whole idea of splitting off.
And again, that's only if they're out of grass. They just go to the top side, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could go to the top side, but how should I say it?
They will do it, okay.
If you have too many sheep for a certain area, you're going to denude the land.
Yeah.
Right, so it doesn't matter if there's lots or not lots. I mean, the text doesn't tell us. What we can infer is that there for sure is an issue of overgrazing. Either that, or there's another issue of the water resources can't replenish themselves fast enough to keep them all there at the same time. And if they start overgrazing the land, that will bring them in conflict with the locals. Right? Because the locals were there originally. You know, imagine Bedouins coming into your land where you've had some of your flocks. I mean, hey, I was here first. You guys get out of here, type thing. So they're trying to avoid conflict with the locals. Either because of water or because of grazing. And I think it's more grazing in this case.
Sure, because that's exactly the situation that's here. Things right. Get overgrazed. Within a month, the rains come up. They've got some wonderful grazing. And then before you've had time to turn around, it's completely overgrazed. They've moved on.
It's never overgrazed. I don't think they overgrazed today. If they overgrazed, it wouldn't go back for several years because the roots would be pulled out.
I asked them this one reason.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
In the fall and not in December.
Yeah.
So right here, this is summertime. If he's in the hill country, it's summertime. That's all.
Grass grazing
in the hill country happens in the summer.
Right.
Which, by the way, tells you that if there are shepherds in the fields, we're not dealing with December.
Absolutely.
Right? And the earliest date that we have in church fathers is May.
But it happened during the time of Isaac, the water, well.
And that happens down in the Negev, where there water is the issue.
Okay,
so there's a debate, yes. There's water issues there, for sure. Later on there is, and even with Abraham there's water issues.
And Isaac too.
But that's in the Negev, right? There they've got large swaths of land that nobody's using. They can, you know, there's few people living down there, but you need to have enough water to be able to survive. Okay, so that's a different situation that's in. Anyways, so he decides to split up with Lot. And he takes him up to a high mountain. And again, the Genesis Apocrypha tells us that that's the mountain which is called Baal Hatzor, which doesn't take a scientist to figure that one out. That's if you go to Bethel and you look around the scenery, the highest mountain you're going to see is called Baal Hatzor. And if he looked and saw the whole land, it's not hard to use your imagination that you could stipulate that he went up on top of that mountain, and that's from there that Abraham and Lot, therefore, look at the land and decide to split. And here is a little thing that happened to me, which I enjoy telling. I was at a site, I wasn't at Baal Hatzor, but I was looking at Baal Hatzor, and I was reading the text with my students, and the text basically says, and I'll read it here. No, I'm not going to read it here, because it gives a translation that, anyways, it says here, raise your eyes now and look from the place where you are. This is Abraham talking to Lot. He says, northward, southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land that you see, I'll give you into your offspring. Oh, sorry. I was skipping them too late. Just wait. I need to go back up. Verse 8. Sorry, verse 9. Is not the whole land before you? Abraham is talking to Lot. Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, I will go to the right. And if you take the right hand, I will go to you to the left. And as I read this with my students, I remembered that there are times in the Bible where right and left is an indication of north and south. And so I wonder,
usually, right?
I don't know if it's usually. I've never done the study. But it, Yamin in Hebrew is right and means also south. That's why you have a country way down in the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula called
Yemen.
Okay, there you hear. That's the south issue coming out. Okay, so right and left can mean north and south. Actually, south and north.
And in Arabic,
that's why she's called the queen of the south. Sheba.
Queen of the south.
Yeah.
In Arabic, to this day, Shamal means north.
Shamal, yeah, no, for sure. So I just paused and I thought, I wonder if it means north and south. So I just stopped and I told my students that. Then we kept reading, and here's what it says. Lot looked around him and saw the plain of the Jordan. Where's the plain of the Jordan?
To the east.
To the east. This changes the story. Right? If you do right and left, you typically think, whatever you choose, I will go the other place. But here he said, look north and look south, and I'll go the opposite direction. Lot here is looking east.
That means he's looking south, because if left is east, he's facing south.
No, it just says he's looking east. Kedem.
Yeah, but if... You said it's either left or right or north and south, right? And so...
Correct.
So, but he just said, okay, I'll take left...
No, he didn't say I'll take left.
He's standing here.
He doesn't say
left. Basically, you're looking south.
He said, I'll take the plains.
I'll take the plains.
Which is the other way.
Which is neither north nor south.
It's east.
Right. It's neither north nor south, so it has to be left or right.
No. No, this is the point of the story.
Right. No, but
Lot's not responding the way to the question.
Abraham is going, you got option A and option B, and Lot looks around and goes, C is way better.
I thought you were saying it can either be north or south or left or right.
No.
And since this is clearly not north or south, he must have understood it as left or right.
Yeah, no, that's not. So I see where you're going, but no.
Yeah.
The left or right is simply north or south. They're synonyms.
Yeah, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And Lot is looking outside and going, whoa, that looks really good over there.
Yeah.
Okay? And what is he seeing? He's seeing a plain that's nice and green. And potentially this is... I mean, it's hard to know exactly how to explain this, but basically, even still today, if you go down to the Jordan Valley, which side of the Jordan Valley is greenest?
The other side.
The other side. Why? Because we've got the Judean wilderness that comes down, and the ridge has gone so far over that for most of the Jordan River, you have no water coming in from the hills to water the plain before you get to the Jordan. Therefore, there's no agriculture there. That is very different from what's on the Jordanian side, where you've got lots of rainwater that comes down that can be channeled to irrigate that whole plain that's there. And therefore, look at most of Jordan's agriculture, not most of it, but a good portion of it happens right there.
And it's not just that. It's just that when the wind comes in and it rises, that produces the rain. Mm-hmm. It rises over the hills of Moab, and so that's the side that gets the rain. It's because it's both. It's not just runoff water.
But it is, because it has to rise, so it actually gets past the plain before it starts raining. Right? So the clouds are coming down, they drop down into the Jordan Valley, and they've got to go up to start raining again, and so it rains on the hills.
So it rains, and it gets runoff water.
But she's right, there's more rain that's hitting
there
on this side, and it's coming down.
Sure. There's more rain that hits this side than this side.
I live on French Hill, and I can see the rain they're getting on the mountains of Moab from my front back door.
No, for sure. They get more rain than what falls east of us here.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The side of the hills of Jordan that face west get more rain than the sides of the mountains that face east.
He didn't have a chance to see what was on this side of it.
He didn't see what was on this side.
Where Abraham was standing when this conversation took place.
He's near Bethel or Ai or Beit In.
From that point.
From that point, when he's looking down, he's looking east, he's only seeing the plain on the eastern side of the Jordan.
Like just down from Amman, like Madaba.
No. I mean, he was on the west bank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was in the west bank.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
From the west bank, look.
Yeah.
Try to imagine.
Yeah, no, exactly. For sure. He's on the west bank, and he's looking there, and he sees that. And he sees... that it's like a garden. What does it mean, like a garden? It means that it can be irrigated year as opposed to the land that he's in right now. And he's like, man, why am I messing with this stuff? That is way better over there. Okay, and I thought, wow, this is an interesting twist to the story that I'd not thought of before.
Is this also shows that he said, you can go left or right? It also shows that Abraham has a concept of the East Bank not being part of the Promised Land in his mind.
No, I didn't.
Very, very, very interesting thought. Because so let me tell the end of my story. So I pass that on and say, hey, I'm wondering if Lot here was really splitting from Abraham at this point right here and saying, you know, I'm done with you. You can have both of this. I'm going over there. It's way nicer there. Okay. And so I said that thought. I said, I wonder if he is just, you know, at the beginning, Lot associated himself with Abraham and would have been, I would call it, co-inheritor of the promises that were made to Abraham. And now suddenly Lot goes over to the other side. He goes over to the other side and says, I'm done. And he's literally saying, you know, great, we got here. I'm going to go over that line. You can do whatever you want here, but I'm splitting from you. I'm going to start my own clan, so to speak. And I came back and I read the JPS, which is right there. And what does the JPS say right after that? It says this. 13:12, I'll read my translation. Abraham settled in the land of Canaan. What does JPS say?
What's JPS?
Jewish Publication Society.
Publication.
It says, I read it if you can't get it. And Abraham remained
in the land.
In the land. Notice what they're hinting at. Remain. That what did Lot do?
He left
the land.
But didn't he go to Sodom? Sodom's on the west bank, didn't it?
Sodom is typically thought to be east of the Rift Valley. Sorry?
About south of the Dead Sea.
It's also, some people think it's also south of the Dead Sea, but still east. However, we have no clue. From
and they, God doesn't give the thing to Abraham to look east and west until chapter 18. So far, the promised land hasn't been defined by east, west, north, and south.
It never gets defined as, I mean, well, right after this, it gets defined in all directions.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, after this.
Right after this, in 13.
Right, so could that not be seen as a consequence of Lot leaving, and this, how God is including it because of love, in a sense.
So here's what's hard in the biblical text, and this is part of things that we need to wrestle through, and I'm just going to take the assumption right now, we're not going to spend time trying to figure it out, but I'm going to take the assumption that the Jordan River is the eastern boundary of the land promised to Abraham. I'm just going to make that assumption right now, because the Bible itself gives us different perspectives of what's the promised land. So some descriptions of it have the Jordan River and the Rift Valley as the boundary, and others don't.
It's fluid.
It is fluid. But in this case right here, I'm going to make the assumption that it is the Jordan River. And then what happens is that Lot goes on the other side. I'm following the same rationale as what JPS. What I was pleased about when I came home and saw the JPS is that they had given the same reading of the text as I had kind of thought of when I was with my students. Okay, so I know that there's this whole dynamic of how far does the promised land goes, but I'm just saying, practically speaking, the promised land has never really gone to the other side of the Jordan River. Even when Moses comes in, remember, there's the 2.5 tribes that want to stay on the other side. Well,
they're kind of seen as sort of outsiders.
Yeah, you guys, you're not quite making it there. You know, like there's this division that happens at the Jordan River that is quite clear throughout the rest of Israel's history.
You mean like Gilead and the half tribe of Manasseh?
Right. Yeah.
Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh.
So the promised land is a different terminology than to the Euphrates River described in Joshua later.
Well, see, this is the problem we have, because in Numbers chapter 34, I think it is, we have the boundaries of the land, and it doesn't go all the way to the Euphrates River. It stops at the Jordan River. So we have different descriptions of this land in different places, and that's why I'm saying there's some... We don't know what, it's fluid, but that's why I'm also saying, but practically speaking, throughout the history of the Israelites, the Jordan River typically is seen. Why is the crossing the Jordan River seen so significant under Joshua? Because they were outside the land and they're going inside the land.
Hence a few plague problems today.
Okay. How that worked itself out for the next 3,000 years is a different topic.
And Moses is very clear. He's on that side, on the eastern side.
Moses is not allowed to enter.
He's not allowed to enter in. He can look over and see it all.
So that's my assumption. That was the boundary. Lot was outside of it, as the JPS suggests, that Lot was outside and lives in this land right here. Okay. And right after that, the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from him, raise your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. The question is, does the east there include the land that he went into, or is that just eastward all the way up to the Jordan? We'll leave that here. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. I'll make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring will also be counted.
What verse is that? 13,
14, 15, 16, something like that. Okay.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I'm still stuck.
That is fulfilled when you look, because Ishmael is also part of his descendants, and so that would include east,
even,
west, north,
even
south.
You, like you were saying before, that Lot could be seen as part of his descendants in the sense that part of the family clan. It could be kind of comfort that even though Lot has left you and gone that way, he's part of you, and so now that land's going to be.
If you see the eastward meaning of that, you could see it that God's saying, well, now I'm extending it beyond.
Because Lot is your seed, and now you're just going to multiply your blessing even beyond.
That is a possible reading, and I think we should entertain that reading of it, which I've never entertained before. But I think we should entertain it that he's seeing third land even getting bigger. Like, so he went to the best part. You're staying here.
Another reinforcement of your understanding that he sees Lot as part of his descendants is him giving him the option to decide
where he's going to go, because it doesn't matter. This
you're part of.
I'm part
of the deal.
I'm doing something better for my kids than I do for myself.
Yeah,
because
you couldn't have Abraham being so frivolous with God's promise for him as saying, "Well, hey Joe, you decide where you want to go, and then I'll just take the dregs." Because obviously, if we're both heir bearers of this promise, then it doesn't matter because we're both.
Well, it's not even just both. It's Abraham, next generation Lot, next generation the descendants of Lot.
Right.
So I'm even,
yeah, and I'm even less significant. Actually.
Exactly.
So you should get the better pick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll get the retirement ranch. You get the. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
In fact, you know, Abraham gave the first choice to Lot.
He did, for sure.
In verse 9.
Yeah, no, for sure, he did. But I just want us to remember that maybe Lot here did something that Abraham had not expected him to, and that maybe he's moved outside of the land of Canaan, and maybe God has then extended the promise beyond, but maybe not. There's some ambiguity still here, right?
Abraham was just a nice guy. He was giving. I wonder if they're just looking for now, this generation. What are we looking at right now? He's thinking descendants. He's thinking the sheep grazing, the rain. What's going to happen? You know, 100 years from now, maybe.
Is Abraham
he's looking right there, right there. What looks best right now? How's the weather going to change? I don't know. What looks best?
So let's keep those thoughts in mind, and let's move on now to the next story. What's the next story?
Sodom.
Okay, Sodom is attacked. It's not Sodom quite yet, but Sodom is attacked. Okay, the king of Sodom, King Gomorrah, and others are going after King Chedorlaomer of Elam. Okay, and they're attacked. And what happens to Lot and all these cities? They're taken captives. What's Abraham's response to this? Why does he go to rescue them? Now, the simple answer is, it's his nephew.
Yeah.
But in the light of what God has been promising him, why is Abraham going after it?
It's the promise.
If there ain't no Lot, there's no descendants. Therefore, if he got captured, God is going to do what he needs to do to allow me to get him back here so that we can have it.
Well, that's one thing I read previously, and when I was thinking that Lot of Abraham's nephew, but if you read the genealogy and
so there is that theory as well.
I'm thinking that she had a lot of influence in all these stories that this is not just a nephew, but this is my brother. Let's give him a break. Let's give you this. Let's go back and rest here. She put a lot of pressure on him to do that.
For sure there's a family connection here, but no matter what the influence, even if there is that connection between Sarah and Lot, for Abraham, the promise God gave to him is your descendants. Whereas descendants, they're now in captivity, being taken back to where he came from originally, even further east. And he's going to get them back. I mean, that's just, if God allowed this, I mean, even if God didn't allow, I need to be faithful and make sure that I bring him back. So he sets up with his own men, goes and pursues them, captures them, and then here we get this really bizarre thing in chapter 14. Why do I say bizarre? So he's able to bring Lot back. He's able to bring back everybody else. He's able to bring back the spoils of war. And verse 17. Well, let's go on. Let's go to 16. Then he brought back all the goods and also brought back his nephew Lot with his goods and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And this is typically seen as happening in Jerusalem. And King Melchizedek of Salem, or Jerusalem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of the God Most High. He blessed and said, "Blessed Abraham by God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abraham gave him one-tenth of everything. Then the king of Sodom said to Abraham, "Give me the persons, but keep the spoils." In other words, you've gone out to war, you've captured all this, according to the laws of war, whoever you capture, people-wise, they become your slaves. So the king of Sodom says, "Listen, at least give the people back, but keep all the spoils of war. You get to keep all of that, and you can become wealthy with that." But Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to Yahweh, the God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or sandal thong of anything that is yours, so that you might not say, 'I have made Abraham rich.' I'll take nothing but what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshkol, Mamre, let them take their share." In other words, I have people who came in the league with me. I'm not going to impose my restricted view of how I want to be rewarded. They can be rewarded according to the customs of the, you know, they'll do that. But then everything else is yours. Okay, I'm giving it all back to you. Now, what's missing in this passage? And this, it's missing and it's glaring, in my opinion. Who came to thank Abraham for the success?
Melchizedek.
Melchizedek, who else was grateful?
King of Sodom.
King of Sodom.
Lot didn't say anything.
Lot is not even in there. There's no indication anywhere that Lot is like, "Thanks, uncle."
Lot was feeling his shock and pains, probably.
That's you.
But I find it interesting. We get this story where all these people are, and the only people who come and express their appreciation to Abraham are two Gentile individuals. And Lot, there's no indication that Lot expresses thanks, that he, I mean, it's just, he's not there in the story. And I think we need to think about that. What's happening with Lot? Why isn't Lot like, "Thank you for coming and saving me"? I don't know, okay? Verse chapter 15. Let's keep that on. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. "Do not be afraid, Abraham, your shield. Your reward shall be very great." He had just given away all of the spoils. God comes back and says, "Your reward will be very great." But Abraham said, "O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." Now here we have a hint that potentially what happened here is Abraham saw that this rift that happened between him and Lot was reconfirmed. In other words, the absence of Lot in chapter 14, Abram is going, "Oh my goodness, this guy doesn't want to have anything to do with me anymore." Now maybe God's still going to do something there, but it sure doesn't look like it. I don't know, but he seems to have a hint here that's,
this guy's useless.
Yeah, like there definitely seems to be, Lot is no longer considered in the story, at least, as being part of everything that's happening to Abram. And even Abraham is starting to consider that Lot may not be part of it. And I wonder if it's as a result of this event that just took place right here.
It's like two people breaking up. One thinks it's just a brief separation. The other one's leaving for good.
Yeah. That good analogy.
Or, yeah, and it's God testing Abraham the whole way, because Lot has never been part of the plan. And God knows that Abraham has been thinking it, but he's just been stringing him along the whole time.
I prefer thinking that Lot was part of the plan until he cut himself out.
I think it's also part that Abraham, it's like the penny drops. You know, first of all, whether Sarah's barren or not, we're not sure, but it would seem that she was. he's still got this promise. Lot was the only one around who could possibly fulfill it. And suddenly Lot's not in the picture. So, Lord, who's going to inherit?
This is
like the penny drops rather than, oh, he's not, you know.
But my perspective is that Lot, you think the plan changes? I think the promise was given to Abraham, but I think that Lot...
You think the miracle of them having kids is like a fix?
No. I'm not thinking it's a fix. But I think that Lot, when he... I think it could have still happened even if Lot had continued to go with Abraham. But I think Lot could have been part of the promise.
Okay. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But Lot chose not to go. And so now it's really obvious. It's not Lot. Mm-hmm. And listen to what... Sorry, Gary?
You could be like the prodigal son.
He could be like the prodigal son. That's a possibility as well.
But Lot would have been the promise until Isaac came.
Sorry?
Lot would have been the promise until Isaac came. And then...
That it would have been shared. That's my perspective. I think...
Lot was not on his mind. He was thinking of Eliezer from Damascus.
Lot Abraham was. Abraham was.
Yeah.
Abraham.
Yeah, but Abraham is thinking that now because Lot is no longer there.
Right.
I think that's what's happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So now, let's look what happened. Look at verse 4. But the word of Yahweh came to him, this man, i.e. Eliezer of Damascus, shall not be your heir. No one but your own issue shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look towards the heaven, count the stars. If you are able to count them, then he said, so shall your descendants be. And what happens right here? And Abraham believed Yahweh, and Yahweh reckoned to him as righteousness. And maybe at the end of this study, if we have time, we'll have Randall talk a little bit more about this verse. But right now, I just want to say, what's amazing right here is Abraham goes, what? I mean, he lots out, and God says, don't worry. The descendants, it's going to be yours. And Abraham believed it. Abraham believed it in the context of what? Let's say 40, 50 years of marriage. And no kids. And yet Abraham believed it. That's amazing.
And for the first time in biblical history, intellectual faith is considered righteousness. It.
Well, no, because that's where we need Randall coming in.
Oh.
I would say no. I would call it intellectual faith. I would call it just living your life in light of what God has told you.
It's a continuative verb. He had been believing.
Oh, okay.
So not only at this point,
he was believing. Yeah.
He was believing, and he continued to believe.
In modern Hebrew, it would have been vehaya ma'amin. And then you get some of the punch. Vehaya ma'amin. It's
and for those of you in English, it should be and he was believing, right?
Exactly. And so when you
kept on
the story,
he kept on believing.
When you're reading the story in biblical Hebrew, and you're thinking with biblical Hebrew norms, that verse hits you pretty hard. When an Israeli reads it, they're reading along, and the Bible is funny, 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 funny dialect. And all of a sudden, oh, here's a verse like our language, and then it goes back to funny again. That's how an Israeli reads the text. And so when they see Behemin, it doesn't hit them, because that's how they would say, and he believed God. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Septuagint translators did. Mm-hmm. And it's stayed with all of the English, the European translations ever since. But in the biblical...
Well, because it gets picked up in the New Testament, the Septuagint does, and so therefore people read it back on there. But the Hebrew doesn't say what the Septuagint
says. The Hebrew says, and Abraham was believing.
That's not really English either. He kept on believing.
He kept on believing.
But it doesn't say. It doesn't say when the beginning or the end was. It's just looking at this ongoing process, and we all read it as, oh, right there,
something happened.
Something happened, and right there, Abraham became a believer.
But
if you follow Brian's line of thought that up till now he's seen Lot as part of his inheritance, he saw a way for the promise to happen physically. So yeah, even if it's improbable, there's still somebody. If at this point there's nobody, and now God's saying it's going to be from you, you know, and you're 90,
and he kept on believing.
So you may have said, okay, up till now, I could have swallowed it. That's going too far. So I think when it says he was believing, it's with the impact of he, even now, continued to believe.
Correct.
Even when this is completely outlandish option. And that's why it goes back to, and he credited to him as righteousness, that he could still believe when God gave him such a crazy promise.
And that's also why I think in the New Testament you have double perspectives on this. They're writing in Greek, and so the Greek has it set without some of this nuance. Nevertheless, you get an epistle like James, and he says, we see that Abraham's faith was made perfect through his works, when he offered up Isaac, which is seven chapters later in the text. I think James could read the Hebrew and could sense that this was all one.
This was a kept-on-believing process.
And so, for him, he never had any problem seeing the whole thing as a long, faithful trajectory. And so he was able to write in Greek and write a Greek epistle and make that point. And that's why you get both points in the New Testament.
And so you're also saying here about this kept on believing, or he could just continue believing, that it's not a matter of him saying, yes, I still believe it's true type thing, but he remained committed to the call.
Faithful.
Yeah, he remained faithful to what God called him to do, and so he just kept doing it.
Correct, but the ante was upped. That's the point. The story right here is saying the ante has just been upped.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, I'm going to provide for you. You have a bank account. You deplete your bank account. God says, I'm going to provide you. Someone gives you a check for $5,000. You can still believe. And suddenly, you don't have any money and a long time here. Do you see what I mean? Like, there's an extra upping the ante.
He just said something outrageous is going to happen.
Correct.
Too. Like, he said, I want you to go there, and you're still marching.
Yeah.
But now he's told you that you're going to cross that rift and there's no bridge there. But you're still going to be able to cross, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, it's amazingly personal, because the Lord does say things to us.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's not dramatic, and, you know, most of us aren't expecting to have children at our age. But it's, nevertheless, whatever the promise is that's going to happen, we just have to stick with it. And I think this phrase, which was the going on believing, is really important for all of us in every situation. It can be something very, very simple. And most of us drop it by midday. You know, he tells us something in the morning, by midday.
Well, a lot of us can believe when we can figure, oh yeah, I can see how that can work, that God wants me to do that.
That's right.
I can see how that works. And the minute that how I saw it could work starts falling apart,
that's right,
we're like, well, is this really what God wanted me to do? Because we're no longer seeing it. And here what we see is Abraham, everything's falling apart. And God says, oh, it's still going to work in a way that you can't figure out, you can't in your brain rationalize. And he's like, okay.
And in everyday life, you know, something happens.
So,
and I get desperate, and I think, however am I going to work that out? I haven't got the time, I haven't got the whatever, whatever, whatever. And somebody turns up at the door, can I mend them, whatever?
Yeah.
You know, which you never thought would ever get repaired, let's say. I mean, it's just out of my head. But
Brian, God did appear to him in a vision, and I think, you know, Danny, back to the intellectual mind he's given us, God did encounter him. He did hear from God. It wasn't something he was trying to force into
him. Well, Danny was talking about, when we use the word faith in English, a lot of us think of it like summoning up some kind of internal energy to, like, okay, I believe this.
Or mental assent to the truth of a statement.
Right. Where faith in the Bible, there's that aspect that inspires you, but it's actually committing your life day in, day out.
To be lived out in a way that is consistent with. So he's living his life consistent to the call that put on us. That's his believing.
Right. In fact, most of the places, emunah, which we translate faith, is used in the Old Testament of describing God. Yeah. And when it describes God, it always is translated faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden when it describes other things, it's like we get this faith thing. And what is the difference between faith and faithful? in English we like keep those in separate categories, but they're actually part of the same.
So our faith is being faithful to God.
I will believe. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to make a choice. I will believe.
Yeah. And then you're going to do it because you
I'm
you
believe
that
choice.
You're
going to
do it.
Do it.
These are wonderful observations. I want to still try to press forward to the end of this 5,000. So I'm going to cut it off. Not that these observations aren't superb, and I'm very glad they're being made. Chapter 16. Now Sarah, Abraham's wife, bore no children. Duh. I mean, this is the whole point of what's been going on so far. Okay. She had an Egyptian slave girl. Oh, where did this Egyptian slave girl come from? Back when they're in Egypt, probably. Whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abraham, who's telling whom? Sarah's telling Abraham, you see that the Lord has prevented me from bearing children.
God's fault.
So it's his fault.
It's his fault, but it's not going to happen for me. If God wanted to, I could have had kids, but God didn't allow me to have kids. Therefore, here's the solution. Go into my slave girl. This is the perfectly acceptable way of dealing with issues in the ancient Near East. There's one other way of dealing with it. How does a family deal with no kids? How does a couple deal with no kids?
You get another wife.
You get a second wife. What did Abraham not do? He did not get a second wife. What does that tell us about his love for Sarah? Notice another story in the Bible. Go to Samuel. Penina. And I'm forgetting your name. Hannah. Why did he have a second wife? Because he had no kids from Hannah. And so he got a second wife, Penina. And Abraham did not choose this option. He did not do anything that would have been offensive to Sarai. And so even in these desperate times, like he needs to have kids. I mean, put it from a human perspective. God said, I'm going to have kids. I need to have kids. But he only does it when Sarah finally comes to him and say, you know what? In our society, it's perfectly acceptable for you to have a kid through my maidservant, and that kid will be considered mine. You know, that's perfectly acceptable. Let's do this. Okay? So Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah. So after Abraham had lived 10 years in the land, he's i.e. 85, Abraham of Cana, Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her slave girl, and gave her to her husband Abraham as a wife. He went into Hagar and she conceived. Now we know.
Yeah.
Now we know where the problem lies in this no children relationship. Okay.
This would have been devastating.
And she looked on contempt on her mistress. But what does Abraham think when he has a kid through Hagar?
This is the promise.
God has been faithful. He's answered what he promised he would do. He has accomplished. But then there's a twist in the story. Hagar looked with contempt on her mistress. Then Sarah said to Abraham, may the wrong done to me be on you. This is a weird statement. But anyways, I gave my slave girl to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May Yahweh judge between you and me. I don't want to get into it, but it's a very bizarre thing, as if it's Abraham's fault that this is all happening now. But Abraham said to Sarah, your slave girl is in your power. Do to her as you please. Then Sarah dealt harshly with her, and she ran away. She's pregnant, and she's running away. What does this mean to Abraham? There's the inheritor of my promise running away. Because I'm allowing Sarah to do what she wants. I'm going to say out of love, potentially. And he doesn't override her. He doesn't say, no, we can't do that. God promised.
But Brian, isn't this for Sarah like a sledgehammer to the face? Now I know exactly.
Well, for sure. I understand her side too, right?
She realized she's the problem.
She's been slapped.
Yeah.
I mean, God could have done it there through, I mean, Abraham. So I really am the one that's been kept barren.
Yeah.
Okay, so she sends Hagar away. Hagar leaves. God brings her back, and we're going to go over that very, very quickly. Imagine Abraham. Oh, whew. That was a close one. But now at least Ishmael is back. Okay. Trying to see what I want to read next. So it talks about offspring. I'm in 17. There's a circumcision. Covenant of circumcision. Ah. Verse 17:15. God said to Abraham, "As for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her."
Whoa.
What's Abraham's response? Verse 18. Well, verse 17. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, "Can a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Can Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight." Like, okay, this is getting moves on. This is too much. You know, I have a descendant. Like, why mess this up? I'm having enough trouble right now with Sarah and all this kind of... Can you imagine what... "No, but your wife Sarah shall bear you a son. You shall name him Yitzchak." He will laugh. "I will establish my covenant with him and as an everlasting covenant." Okay? So, then chapter 18. I think it's chapter 18. Yeah, we have the... We need it reiterated to them. Sarah laughs as well. And what happens after 18? The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And notice what Abraham does. Even though now he has his own descendants, he goes and negotiates with God to try to save Lot. He's still acting like he hasn't... If Lot separated himself from Abraham, Abraham has not separated himself from Lot. And he intervenes for him. Lot is saved with his wife, well, for the first part with his wife and his two daughters. Okay? But does Abraham know this? We have no way of knowing that he does. I mean, he knows that there's been a destruction. And then we have this weird story of Lot and his daughters. And Lot and his daughters, what do his daughters say? I'm going too fast now, so I can't find the verse. But what do they say?
There's no man for us.
There's no man for us. What? Like, did they think the whole earth had been exterminated?
Yeah,
no, we got to think clan-wise. Do you marry outside your clan? No. What happened to everybody within the Lot clan? Destroyed. But what could they have done to keep their line going that would not have been going outside?
Gone back to Abraham.
Gone back to Abraham. And they do not choose this option. And instead they choose to keep separate from Abraham. And they end up giving birth to Moab and Edom. And what eventually does God say about Moabites and Ammonites? Sorry, Moabites and Ammonites. Deuteronomy, what is it? No Moabite or Ammonite shall ever come into
the temple.
Is it the temple or the assembly of the Lord or something like that?
Yeah.
Until the tenth generation.
Ruth is...
Ruth is the exception. This is again God's mercy. But right now, what happened is that the choice that Lot made to separate was confirmed by the daughters. And that time, they could have gone back and joined up with Abraham, but they didn't do it. They stayed split. What happens after this? I'm rushing because of the time.
Abraham and the wells, and they take Sarah again.
They take Sarah again, but there's also this other story of Hagar being sent away again with Ishmael. Mm-hmm. Right? Remember that he's weaned, and so there's this party. They send Ishmael away, and this time it's Abraham sending Ishmael away, and he's basically saying, according to what Sarah asked, "You are no longer part of this family. We have rejected you." Not rejected, we have... What would be the good English? We have
cast you off.
You are no longer part of the Abraham clan. Be gone. You have no inheritance here. You're no longer associated with this. You're out of here. Sarah doesn't want you. I'm sorry. You're my son. I love you. But I'm going to do what Sarah wants. You're gone. I disinherit you. What happens after that? Genesis 22. Look at the very top of Genesis 22. Read that first line.
God tested Abraham.
Yes, and verse 2. Take your son. Your only son. Up until a little while ago, he had two.
Yeah.
But you know, something of interest here. You know, what happened with Hagar, you know, something that we don't comment much about it. Ishmael was named by God while he in
the womb.
His mother's womb. same like Isaac.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
So this we have to think about Ishmael.
He's a son of Abraham. Mm-hmm. To Abraham, that was the inheritor of the promises.
13 years, that was the promise. Mm-hmm.
And now somebody says, now maybe Abraham's thinking, you know what, even if I send him away, he's still going to be an inheritor, he's still my son.
But don't you think that he will have a kind of role in, you know, before Jesus comes?
That, I'll leave it to the New Testament theologians. Okay? But let me finish off. Take your son, your only son, because the other one has been cast off, the one you really love, and offer him up as a sacrifice. I mean, talk about upping the ante in the whole life of Abraham right here. It went from something that could be believable, yeah, I can see how I can become a great nation, maybe I'm in such a good leader that people will be attracted, to having to be your own son at a time when it's impossible, through your wife for whom that's impossible, and now that you don't have any other kids, sacrifice that kid. And that's a progression that I never thought about before in the life of Abraham. And I say, no wonder he goes down in history as the father of faith. And since we're over time, may I just say, may we live our lives in consequences of what God asks us to do, the way that Abraham did it. With such unwavering moving forward, regardless of what the odds are. As long as we have that relationship with God where, as Margaret said, we are hearing from God. To continue on. And that's my... that's a perspective that I haven't had until I look deeply at the story of Abraham, and I would like to share that with you for this All Saints Day as an encouragement that we may learn to live like Abraham lived.
Thank you.
Amen.
Amen.
So I don't get my hands slapped too hard. Please go quickly downstairs. Oh, yes!
He's all here.
That's right. So, yes, I remember that. It is a small
world.
No problem. Glad you were able to find it. Yeah, no, I think you reported back.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm all over for across the open trophy. For Isaac, another story.